Hello, everyone. This is M.R. Rangaswamy with In Diaspora Radio. And today we have an amazing guest with us, Jimmy Soni, who is a contributing editor and a columnist for the Washington Examiner. He's a senior advisor to the CEO and editor-in-chief of the New York Observer Media Group. You must have heard about him. He writes a lot on the intersection of technology, policy, and politics. He was most recently the managing editor of the Huffington Post, also called by many as HuffPost. And during his tenure, he was there at age 26, and he helped grow the audience from 40 million to 90 million people, expanded the media to over 11 overseas markets. They won a Pulitzer Prize for reporting and got many other awards. Jimmy was named as Adweek's Young Influentials Under 30, received numerous awards and features, has been featured in Politico, Vogue magazine, Lifehacker, and many other publications. Again, something you may not know about Jimmy, he was the co-author of the first ever modern biography of the ancient Roman senator Cato. In case anyone is really interested, go take a look at that one. And then more recently, he is working on a biography of mathematician and founder of digital information, Claude Shannon, which is due out next year. Jimmy has also worked at McKinsey, and he's been a speechwriter for the mayor of D.C., and he's an avid runner and completed a 50-mile race. He's training for a 75-mile run. And again, his background is not a traditional Indian American. He was born in Toulouse, France. Hopefully we'll get to talk about some French cooking. And he grew up in suburban Chicago. And actually, he's coming to us today from Europe. So Jimmy, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Amar.
Great. Where are you today?
I am in Amsterdam at the moment in the Netherlands.
Okay, great. So terrific. It looks like you're busy writing a book.
I am. It's one of these things. It's a project that I'll be glad to have written it. The writing of it is more difficult, but that is what I'm doing, and it's been a really wonderful process and journey.
Terrific. So, Jimmy, you were born in Toulouse. So take us through your childhood. Where did you grow up? What was it like? Were you living on wine and cheese? You know, what was going on in France?
You know, it's a fascinating story. My father was actually doing his postdoctoral work in Toulouse and in France. And my parents had always kind of anticipated that after his work was done, they would, you know, return home being India. And, I was born in France. My brother was born in France. I lived there until I was about 4 and a half when my father got an opportunity to come to work in the United States. Again, a move that they thought would be temporary. And so they figured they would go to the United States. My father would do some work and then they'd go back home being India. But lo and behold, a couple of decades later, they are still in the United States. I call the United States home, as does my brother. And it's, we have only kind of the only attachments we have to France, I would say, is, the occasional loaf of French bread.
So how was it at 4 and a half moving from Toulouse to Chicago? That must have been quite an interesting experience.
You know, we had a little, we had a stopover in Michigan, but I think that the most peculiar part, according to my mother, is I had been basically forced to learn French and learn Hindi, and now here I was having to learn English. And so she said the most difficult part was when I would get to school and I would basically come home so angry that none of my classmates knew French. And I would throw these just unbelievable tantrums about how nobody spoke French and I wanted to go back home and I didn't like it here. And, those growing pains obviously go away, but that was, those were some of my earliest memories. And then a lot of them are, come to me through my mother, but it was not the easiest adjustment, obviously, things have gotten better since.
Yeah, that's terrific. So how did you end up choosing to go to Duke? I mean, how did you get there?
You know, it's a funny story. I actually applied to something like 15 colleges and universities. I was a portrait of indecision, you could say. And I basically said to myself, okay, these are the schools that I would go to. I applied to all of them, and Duke was incredibly generous with me. They gave me a what's called a university scholarship. And so in addition to the kind of financial resources, Duke also just, they flew me out to the university. They toured you around. They showed you all the best parts of campus. They you know, introduced you to people. And at the end of the day, I had my choice of a number of places, but it was a wonderful, it felt like the university was already making a home for me even before I got there. And that on top of the scholarship, it was just too good to pass up.
Oh, fantastic. And so what did you major at Duke, what did you like about the whole experience?
You know, I still look back so fondly on my time at Duke. It was where I kind of came into my own in several different ways. I ended up designing my own major, actually, and it was a mix of public policy, history, and economics. I found that I was really interested in, to be quite honest, I was interested in taking several classes with a few professors rather than taking many classes with many professors. And so my goal was that I wanted to go a little bit deeper, and so I just, when I was a sophomore, I petitioned the university through a program called Program 2 to give me the ability to break out of the traditional categories and design my own major, which is what I ended up doing. And, you know, it's a bit of a tough thing to justify to your South Asian parents that, that you're going to resist the categories and go ahead and do your own venture. But to be honest, I'm really glad I did it for the simple reason that rather than take, you know, a single class with a range of people, I was able to really develop very meaningful relationships with several faculty members who I'm still friends with to this day. And so I was able to take three and four courses with you know, a few different, a handful of faculty. And those people I count as mentors and friends, and it was a really powerful way to go through an education.
Fantastic. And I know you were pretty active in the student government there, so maybe one of these days is politics in your cards?
You know, I did a little bit of everything at Duke. To be honest, I did a little too much. My friends used to joke that, like, I got to the buffet of college and decided to try every dish. So I was active in student government when I was there. I was also active in the school paper when I was there. I wrote columns and I wrote for the magazine, the newspaper's corollary magazine. And, you know, I basically kind of came to Duke and I wanted to try everything, and I did. And I probably slept less than I should have. But I think I got a lot more out of the university than I had even hoped I would have when I arrived.
Fantastic. And so it looks like you took the more traditional approach when you left to join something like McKinsey. So why did you do that as opposed to doing something else?
Yeah, you know, I look back on it, and it probably is the most traditional part of my background. After graduating, I went off to Ireland to do some graduate work on a scholarship called the George Mitchell Scholarship. Mm-hmm. And when I finished up, you know, I'd been thinking about the things I was interested in, journalism, politics, and there was something about kind of business and sort of the fundamentals of business that I just didn't understand. I had done some writing when I was an undergrad. I had worked for a politician when I was an undergrad, and I had worked on behalf of some faculty members, but I realized that I had not actually sort of seen the inside of a business. And so there was something about that I figured would hold me in good stead no matter what I ended up doing. And so I went and sort of applied and was accepted and went off to McKinsey. And there wasn't, to be quite honest, there wasn't a thought out plan about what I was supposed to get out of it or what I was going to do once I was finished. I just figured this was very, very smart friends and very smart people had gone and spent a little bit of time there and done incredible things. I looked at examples like Bobby Jindal, Sheryl Sandberg, other people. And I said to myself, if people like that are emerging from a place like this, it can't be all bad. And so I kind of went and went for it and then left, after my tenure as an analyst to go and join the D.C. city government.
Okay, I didn't realize that. And then from D.C. is when you got into the HuffPost?
Yeah, so the story basically is when I was at McKinsey, I sold the book proposal for the book I ended up writing on this ancient Roman senator whose name was Cato.
Yeah.
And I kind of, my co-author, who's an old friend of mine from Duke, was living in Washington. And so I said to myself, okay, we've got the book deal, but I have to go and find a way to work in Washington and pay the bills. And I was really inspired by the then mayor of Washington, D.C., whose name was Adrian Fenty. And I applied to work in city government. And so I had this extraordinary period of my life, which lasted about 2 years, where I was doing city government by day and I was writing about the Roman government at night. it was a kind of wonderful contrast, although, to be honest, the scary thing was actually how similar they were. And so I basically did that for 2 years, and we sadly lost re-election, and I had to find something else to do. And then a friend of mine from my McKinsey days kind of gave me the lead on this job with Arianna Huffington, and the rest was history. After I met her, I moved up to New York a week and a half later and started working for her.
Wow. And that was quite a ride. I mean, you were 26. How did she pick you at that age, and how did you, get?
Yeah. I will never know. My interview started at 7 o'clock, and at 7:15 she offered me the job. And it was one of the, I mean, she's a famously fast decision maker, but I still wonder about why it happened. But you know, it was a wonderful experience, and I learned more in that short period of time than I think I have in any other experience I've had. And it gave me an exposure to digital media and to digital journalism, which kind of shapes everything I do today.
Wow, that's amazing. And what were the highlights? I mean, you joined this organization. They're you know, hardly that well-known other than Arianna. How do you take something like that and grow it and double in size and go to 11 markets? And, I mean, what was that ride like?
To be honest, when I got there, HuffPost was already basically a household name, right? The biggest shift that happened when I arrived was the growth of traffic from social networks like Facebook and Twitter. And so I don't want to overstate kind of my contribution, but if I did anything, it was just kind of orienting the content creation in the direction of social media. And at the same time, you saw a significant increase in the outbound traffic going from those places to places like the Huffington Post or the New York Times or BuzzFeed or any of the other entities. And we developed that the combination of science and art, and we saw extraordinary growth. And again, it was a big team, and there were a lot of people, and I was privileged to play a small part in that. You know, the other thing about coming to New York, diving into journalism, and you know this better than almost anybody, is the number of wonderful people like Sri Srinivasan, who you've had on the show, and Raju Narasetty, and Mitra Kalitra, and folks who are a part of the community who stepped up to help me. I mean, it was really extraordinary just to see the range of people through organizations like Saja and others and Sama who came out and were kind of bent over backwards, answered any phone call, took meetings, all the rest. I mean, it's a really incredible thing to think about the growth of the South Asian journalists where, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, we're talking about a small handful of people. Now you have people kind of at masthead level positions in almost every newsroom in the country who are South Asian.
Well, it's fantastic to see. So, Jimmy, don't go away. We'll be back after a short break. Hello, everyone. This is M.R. Rangaswamy again with Indiaspora Radio. I'm here with Jimmy Soni. So, Jimmy, continuing our conversation here, you keep reinventing yourself every couple of years, and now you left HuffPost, and you're now writing a book. So tell us more about this decision and what you're up to these days.
Yeah, you know, I have like a, I think this gene where I enjoy organizational development and organizational leadership, but I also really enjoy writing, and I love books. And I've loved books ever since I was a little kid. And after I, you know, had the chance to write my first book, I got to thinking about a second book, perhaps on the principle that, you know, sort of once lucky, twice good. I needed to make sure that I was actually good at this. But I was reading about, and this will speak to you as somebody who's in the technology space and has done all the amazing things you've done. But I was reading about Bell Labs. Bell Labs was, in the 20th century, arguably one of the most innovative companies in America, and it was certainly one of the largest companies in America. And I was reading a wonderful book about Bell Labs, and I came across an engineer and a mathematician who was integral to the sort of development of what's called information theory. The kind of, think of it as like the intellectual underpinning of digital information and of everything that comes into your iPhone today. And I wanted to buy a book on him because Einstein had actually called him the foremost mind I've ever met in my life. And I figured if Einstein was saying that, then this was a guy worth reading about. And so I went hunting for information about him, and I didn't find a biography. And I said to myself, this is really kind of an extraordinary gap in the history of the development of technology, because this person's contributions matter a great deal. And so I did, you know, put together a proposal. My agent was supportive, and we were grateful to sell it to Simon & Schuster. And so I am plugging away on that project now and learning more math than I think I have since high school, which is really quite an experience.
So tell us a little bit about the book. How did you approach this book, and how are you trying to tell the story of this mathematician to the average layperson?
Well, part of it is in this field and for this topic, I am the average layperson. So it's wonderful, because if I were a mathematician, this book would almost be harder to write for a lay audience. And so what I'm really trying to do is just kind of capture who Shannon was, how he lived his life, what were his major breakthroughs. This is a guy who, in addition to his work on digital information, was one of the pioneers in the study of juggling. He wrote one of the most important papers on juggling that was out there. He was a blackjack player. He was an investor. He was a unicycle designer. He was an extraordinary mind. And the book is actually tentatively titled A Mind at Play, Claude Shannon and the Invention of Information, partly because he represents the kind of tinkerer that we think of when we think of somebody like Ben Franklin or Thomas Jefferson, a sort of the old guard mathematician who used mathematical and engineering principles, but applied them to so many different things. And so we're focused on, telling the story of his work on information theory and on communication, but I'm just as interested in his work on cryptographic analysis during World War II. He helped break several important Japanese codes and German codes. I'm just as interested. He was the first person to develop a wearable device. And in an era in which Apple is about to presumably conquer that market, I think it's important to study the roots and the antecedents of a lot of these developments. Mm-hmm. And so I'm interested in filling this gap in history. And what's been really amazing is that a number of Shannon's colleagues, friends, family members have been completely open with us, let us interview them for 2 and 3 and 4 hours at a time. And they've told us about this incredible human being who did some amazing mathematical work, and so much of it kind of on his own in a West Village apartment in New York, where he would just sort of write things out on a chalkboard. It's an extraordinary story. And MR, I am going to include you in the movie if you will allow me to when it's out.
That sounds like a deal. So when are you going to complete this, and when is it coming out?
The goal is to have it done by this fall, and to have it hopefully released next year. But the best laid plans, and so we'll see how all that comes together. Books are notoriously just difficult to track when it comes to their timing.
Right.
I remember even having a slight delay with my last one, but the truth is that, I think that there's just a huge opportunity I think that there's something interesting, which is we now have devices and a sort of information architecture that we often take for granted. And so for me, telling this story is a way of just reminding people that, these things have roots, and it's actually incredibly important to understand their roots. And so that's how I think about this project. And I'm hopeful that it'll do well.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I know you go back to Duke and not just to watch the basketball games, but you did a TEDx at Duke. What was that all about? What was the topic, and how was the reception to you going back to the university?
I've been really fortunate in having the chance to actually stay pretty active with the university after graduating. I serve on a couple of boards there, and I go back to the university relatively frequently to just talk to students, to kind of connect with undergrad to, you know, really just sort of keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on. And I was really fortunate in having the chance to give a TEDx talk. And I you know, it was about my life. I think it was like 3 years ago, so I don't remember the exact details, but I remember speaking about history, about France, and about kind of the way that I think that sometimes we misteach history. We teach history as a sort of dry recitation of facts and information, when actually history is story, right? It's narrative. Yeah. And if you read through narrative, people become much more engaged. And so there's, you know, it's the kind of thing that you sort of take it and run with it, and you hope people enjoy it. I had a pretty good reception to it, and so it seemed to work.
Fantastic, fantastic. So, you know, we did some research on you, Jimmy, and found out that, you know, your work habits are quite different, in that one of the things I think about you is you work standing up. So is that how you're writing your book? You stand up and you pound away on your computer, or?
Oh, yeah, I did. I am a fan of standing desks, and I sort of believe this adage that's become popular now, which is that sitting is the new smoking. There's pretty compelling evidence that suggests that that the amount of sitting we do is affecting our health in some important ways, and negative ways. And so I do try to stand. To be honest, I had a standing desk. I don't now, but what I try to do is just move around as much as I can. It is one of those peculiar things that I just find I'm more energetic when I'm standing. And if it were possible, I would probably get some kind of treadmill desk so I could be moving while I was typing. But at the moment, it's not possible.
That's terrific. So tell us something about yourself that people may not know.
Oh, boy. well, you know, I guess I've written about it, but it was one piece of a, and I haven't really kind of talked about it at length or anything, but one of my peculiar hobbies, I guess, is I enjoy ultra marathon running, and it's a recent hobby, and I don't know what the future of it for me looks like, but 2 years ago, I completed a 50-mile ultra marathon, and I'm training for a 75-mile race. And I wrote about this for runnersworld.com, and had the chance to tell the story. But it basically, you know, the marathon distance is 26.2. Anything beyond 26.2 is considered an ultra marathon. And there's a very small community of particularly insane people who choose to take on these challenges. And I was really fortunate in finding a great race and completing it with a friend, and it got me hooked. So my goal is ultimately to try to tackle some distances that are 100 miles or longer. But it's a fun sport, and you know, I want to do it for as long as my knees will let me.
So what was your timing on the 50 miles?
I think I did it in 10 hours and 23 minutes, and the cutoff was something like 12 or 13 hours. The truth is, with an ultra marathon, you don't. Except for the very few people who are at the very top of the sport, what you're trying to do is just make it through the race. You're not, you're really not running for speed.
Right.
You are running for pure endurance. And so you walk a fair bit, you eat during the middle of the race. It's a very different run than people are accustomed to. And so it was a fun experience. And I'm actually looking forward to trying some longer distances, much to the chagrin of my parents and my friends.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you do all this stuff. So, Jimmy, what do you do to relax? I mean, what?
Yeah, that's a great question. I wish I had a good answer. I mean, I enjoy reading. I enjoy spending time with friends and family. You know, I'm not a big TV person, but, you know, I'll occasionally sort of watch a show here or there. I love House of Cards, and I love Game of Thrones. But to be honest, I'm one of those rare people. I find a lot of my work to be very relaxing. And I find reading to be very relaxing, and reading also happens to be a big part of my work these days. I write a weekly column on technology policy, and I find that I spend a lot of my free time just reading about kind of various topics at the intersection of tech and politics and policy. And so I feel very lucky that the stuff that relaxes me is also the stuff that I have to do for work. But, you know, every now and again, you can find me on the couch watching an episode of House of Cards.
That's great. So, Jimmy, this has been a great conversation, and hope to see you soon as well at our India for a weekend.
Yeah, I really appreciate you all doing this, and it really is such – I mean, the work that Indiaspora has done is just incredible. And I look at kind of the faces who have attended your conference and the people who have spoken to you and done this show, and these are people who I'm lucky to count as friends, but they're also people who are just so inspiring in what they do. And so to have a chance to participate, I can't thank you guys enough.
Great. Thanks, Jimmy. Again, Indiaspora Radio is produced by Monica Patel. Theme music is by Jahan Shah. The interlude music is by our very own Rina Ismail. So long, everyone.